Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest tonight grew up in Philadelphia, was an amateur boxer, a nightclub singer, and pianist. He became a writer and has been voted the number one sports columnist in the nation 13 of the past 15 years. He's a panelist on ESPN's Sports Reporters and is the author of 8 books, including Tuesdays with Maury and The 5 People You Meet in Heaven. He's written 3 plays and hosts a nationally syndicated radio talk show. His name, Mitch Albom, and I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
You're listening to Anything is Possible with Jack Krasula, sponsored by Trust in Us on News Talk 760 WJR.
We're talking to Mitch Albom, the author of Tuesdays with Maury, the best-selling memoir of all time. Mitch, welcome. It's an honor.
Hi, Jack. Thank you. So,
can you start by talking about your childhood and your parents?
I grew up in southern New Jersey and the Philadelphia area. My parents were pretty typical of the time, which was the 60s. My mom stayed home and raised us. My dad went to work each morning. We lived in such a sort of age of innocence that I honestly didn't know what my father did for a living until I was 16 years old. I just knew he went to work. And when I had to start filling out college applications, it was the first time I said to him, well, what do you actually do? Because they had a rule that you didn't talk about work when you were at home or at the dinner table or anything like that. And so we led a very much a family-oriented life. And my mother was the creative one. My dad was more of sort of the straight-laced, go-to-work business type. And I got probably a little bit of both of them in me. And I have a sister and a brother, an older sister, younger brother. And all of us were into either music or art or performing, or none of us really that into writing, interestingly enough, but including me. I wanted to be a musician when I was growing up, but I think I knew early on that I wasn't going to sit behind a desk for the rest of my life.
What did your dad actually do?
You know, he explained it to me, and I'm not sure I know. He was like a middle-level manager for a company, handled contracts and things like that, and he sort of did some of the negotiating of the contracts. I like to say that what my father did was raise his family, you know, and he was is a honest, straightforward, well-liked, quiet, respected man. And, you know, some people don't get a chance to look up to their father, but I did, and I still do. And really what he does for a living is, we tease that he's in the CIA. We actually think he's, you know, he's so quiet about it. We say, you got like a whole double life going on, don't you? But I think his character is more important than his job.
Where did you get your love for sports and writing?
Well, you know, honestly, I don't have, Jack, as much of a love for sports as you might think, given what I've done. My love was always for writing and for creativity. I was a musician when I got out of school, and that's all I ever wanted to be. And I tried the music business. First, I lived overseas in Europe, and I played piano and sang in clubs over there, and eventually came back to New York, where I planned to make my name for myself. And I lived the whole struggling musician routine there in New York City and nightclubs and stuff like that. And I really wasn't having any success at it. And while I was trying to be a musician and failing miserably, I volunteered during the day at a local newspaper just to have something to do during the day, because musicians work at night. And they were looking for some help for one of those newspapers that they give away in supermarkets, the free kind. And I wrote one story for them, and I saw my name in the paper, you know, over this little story about parking meters, I think it was. And I thought, well, that's pretty cool. You know, you have your name there and you can see something you wrote. So I wrote another story for them. I never got paid a cent, but those are the first things that I ever had in print. And I think I just caught the bug and went on from there. Sports became just an accident. You know, when I was in Columbia, I went back to graduate school to get a graduate degree. I needed to help pay for my tuition, and they had a little job board up there, where, you know, jobs for students, and one of them was at Sport Magazine. If it had been Sewing Magazine, I probably would have been a sewing writer. If it had been Business Magazine, I would have been a business writer. Just so happened it was at Sport Magazine. I went over there, I started writing for that, and I sort of fell into sports and have been in it ever since.
You're a fantastic storyteller. How did you get so good at storytelling?
Well, thank you for saying that, and I consider that the highest compliment, because really, I think that's all I do. You know, a lot of people will say, okay, you do so many different things and you're on this or that, but really, it's one thing. I'm only good at one thing. I can tell a story. And where I learned that, to be honest, Jack, is at our dinner table. I came from a family of a lot of relatives who would gather around at the drop of a hat, and I love that. I still do. And our Thanksgivings in particular, we would have, you know, sometimes 40, 50 relatives there. And you had to learn how to tell a story if you wanted to hold anybody's attention, because everybody was trying to tell a story. And I remember my older uncles and aunts and grandparents. In fact, my Uncle Eddie, upon whom the book The Five People You Meet in Heaven was based, he was a great storyteller, and he used to say, well, now when I was in the war, we used to go here, and then someone would say, oh, we've heard this story before, don't you know, and so we'd have to make it more interesting in order to get it to there. And I think I picked up on how you hold somebody's attention. You got to get to it fast, and you got to have things happen, and you can't delay. And I think that was the earliest influence of me learning how to write stories.
Why are people so inspired by stories?
Well, I think it's simple. I mean, stories are the way that we have communicated since the dawn of time. I mean, since we were drawing pictures on walls of caves, it was always a story. And I think sometimes people get caught up in trying to analyze things or make details out of things or talk about big global issues. But if you can just put a face on a story, you can say, well, here's a story of a boy, and this is what happened to this boy, and this is how this boy felt, and here's what happened in the end. People can always relate to that, rather than when you say, well, there's 57% of the population suffers from this, that, or the other thing. People can't focus on that. But when you just say, let's tell the story of one boy, one man with Lou Gehrig's disease, one old man who goes to heaven and meets five people, when you make it a specific story about a specific character, people can focus on that. There's something inside of us that likes to hear stories. I guess it goes back to when we were, you know, 2-3 years old, and what would tell our parents, you know, tell me a story, tell me a story, tell me a story. Well, I don't think you ever lose that. I think there's part of us that's still a kid that always wants to hear a story, and I guess that's what I do.
We're talking to Mitch Albom, and I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
This is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR with Jack Krasula.
Welcome back. We're with Mitch Albom, who's been voted the number one sports columnist in the nation 13 of the past 15 years. Mitch, three times in the last 5, 6, 7 years, you and I have sat next to each other just by chance on that 10:30 flight or so coming back from New York City to Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
And you always come in 1 or 2 minutes before they're closing the door. You got these plastic bags loaded with papers and magazines. You sit down, you say hi, they give you something to drink, and you start to go to work. And you're ripping stuff out, and you're circling stuff, and you're throwing stuff on the floor. What do you read daily and weekly, and how do you file all that stuff when you get back home?
Well, that's the part of my life that has more to do with the radio program that I do or my newspaper column, not my books so much. And I read about 6 newspapers a day. I read the 2 from Detroit. I read the New York Times. I read the Wall Street Journal. I read USA Today. And usually I read the Washington Post or Los Angeles Times. Remember, I have had a newspaper career, so it's not unusual for me to sort of gravitate towards newspapers. But I like to see different people's points of view on the same stories. And what I do on those airplanes, and sorry if I've probably woken you up a few times, when I see a good story, I just rip it out of the paper and I crunch it up, I fold it up and I stick it in my pocket. And sometimes by the time I get off those planes, my pockets are bulging out. But when I get home, I throw them onto the counter. And then the next day, which is usually Monday, I bring them with me to the WJR studios or wherever I'm going. I say, hey, here's a good story, or here's a good story, here's a good story. And I find that you know, there must be some more scientific way to do it, but I don't know how. That seems to me to be the best way. You see it, you rip it, you mark it, and you put it in your pocket, and then you don't forget about it. And that's given me many a good inspiration. Sometimes I'll just see a sentence, or I'll see a, I'll see an expression that somebody used, and I'll just say, "That's boy, that's interesting. I want to remember that." And I'll, when I get home, I'll write it down. I'll put it in a pad, or I'll put it in a computer, and maybe save it for years down the road when I think there might be a book in it, or you know, might be some offshoot from it. So I feel you should never waste any minute that you read so many great things, you see so many great things, and all of them are potential inspiration if you're a storyteller. But if you just say, "Boy, that would make a great story," and then you go back to what you were doing, you can't rely on your memory 10 years later to say, "Now, what was that thing I thought would make a great story 10 years ago?" You have to have it in front of you, and that's why I do all that ripping and reading.
Recently, you wrote a story about a little girl, and you said, "She's proven, without a word, that when the news breaks your heart, the story can still inspire it." Hmm. What do you mean by that?
Well, that was a story of a baby girl who was born after suffering a stroke in the womb. She happens to be the third child of a couple I know who live out in Grand Rapids. And they had had an idyllic, perfect life. And this was going to be their third child. That was going to be it. They were going to have three little girls. And then all of a sudden, she suffers this terrible stroke in the womb. She's got very little chance of living. And their whole last past year has been trying to keep this little girl alive. And she's proven to be this just miracle child who has survived all kinds of operations and all kinds of specialists and all kinds of doomsayers. And although she hasn't really spoken yet, the fact that she has fought back against these terrible odds, that she's able to smile, that you're able to look at her picture and just be lifted, proves to me that, you know, we think that the only way that you can inspire somebody is by saying something really brilliant or telling a story like that. But here was a little girl who's yet to say her first word, and yet just her struggle has already inspired me, and I think a lot of other people who read that, and that's why I wrote what I did.
We have challenging times in this state. In that same article, you wrote, "Real life is never simple. Real life is sickness, money woes, crying kids, and bags under your eyes." How do you stay so positive?
Well, because I've already seen the negative. You know, when I sat alongside my old professor, Maury Schwartz, and watched him die from maybe the cruelest disease ever invented, Lou Gehrig's disease, which takes everything that you and I would call basic human dignity. You can't even move. You need someone to wipe the tears from your eyes or blow your nose, carry you to the bathroom, wipe your rear end. And I watched him stay positive, and I watched him say, "Well, all right, I'm losing my body. I'm going to lose my life soon, but that doesn't mean that I still can't contribute. I still don't have things to say. I can't, still can't express my love to you or you to me." And once I saw that, I said, "Well, how can I ever really complain about anything again? I mean, look at this guy. You know, I have to lift him when I have to carry him to the bathroom. I mean, I remember doing that kind of thing." And I guess after that, my attitude about life changed quite a bit. And I was able to see that there's always still some good. There's always still something positive, even in terribly negative hands that we get dealt. And you can choose to go the negative way, or you can choose to go the positive way. It's kind of up to you. I mean, you can find something negative in being a billionaire. A lot of billionaires do. Or you can find something really positive in being the poorest person on your block, but you have this, or you have your family, or you have something special, you know, you have a nice cat, whatever it is. And so I guess I would just prefer to be that way. It gets you through life easier.
You've interviewed thousands of people. Hmm. Who was the most fascinating and why?
Ooh, wow. Gosh, Jack, there have been so many in so many different categories that if I picked one, I think it would, you know, I'd immediately think of another. But I would probably say that there were two that come to mind. One was Maury, because I really did interview him. I mean, I interviewed him for 16 straight Tuesdays, and to hear the things that he had to say about life and the way that he could stay positive as he was dying, that was an incredible inspiration. And then I'll give you one from the sports world on the complete opposite side. I went to the Iditarod up in Alaska, the dog sled race. I was the only North American reporter to go up there when I went. This was back in the early 90s. No one had ever come from this side of the States before. And I covered the whole thing. And I met a guy who was entered for the first time. He'd saved up all his money for vacations for like 4 years. And every dime he had, he was a pharmacist from North Carolina. He'd never been to Alaska before. And he just wanted to enter this race. He just thought it was the great. He'd read Jack London and Call the Wild. And he just thought that this was his dream. And he put all these years into going up there. And he took the dogs out. He was in last place. And at one point in the middle of the race, he lost one of his dogs. And you can't advance if you don't have all your dogs together. And he had to go out into the hinterlands of Alaska and chase after this dog for 3 days until he finally found him and brought him back. Now he's 3 days behind everybody else. And when he finally gets to the finish line, he finishes 5 days behind the leaders. And I said to him when I talked to him, you must have been so upset when that dog ran off, meaning, you know, angry. And he said, oh, I was. If anything had ever happened to that dog, I never would have forgiven myself. And I just, you know, I about fell off my chair. And I said, you know, wow. Talk about why people should do things and should compete in sports and whatever. This is it for the love of the event and the honor of the rules of the competition and concern for these animals. And I'll never forget that. I can't remember his name, but I can still remember that story.
We're talking to Mitch Albom. When we come back, we'll ask him which one or two people he would most still like to interview. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
Now back to Anything Is Possible with Jack Krasula, sponsored by Trust in Us on News Talk 760 WJR.
Welcome back. We're with Mitch Albom. Mitch, any two people, dead or alive, and also, what would you ask them?
Okay, I'm going to answer with two people that are completely and diverse from one another. The first will be Mahatma Gandhi. The reason why is because I don't think there really has been a figure like him in my lifetime since he died. And given the conflicting times that we have now, and particularly the religious conflictions that we see in one society against another, I would ask him how it was that he was able to live without hatred and how he was able to bring peoples who really had sworn against one another. I mean, I don't know how much you know the history of India and Pakistan, but they were mortal enemies. And yet he was able to find a common ground without fighting, without resorting to violence. He was a father of a nonviolent movement. I think we've become a country that we laugh at people who suggest not using violence anymore. It's like, oh, you're just soft. You're a wimp. You know, let's go over and kick some butt. We have songs about going over and kicking Iraq's butt. And whether we're justified in doing what we're doing over there or not, I mean, they did terrible. You know, the terrorists that we're fighting have done terrible things to us. I understand that. But I'd like to ask a guy who managed to make his life about nonviolence, how would you do that today? Could you do it today? I don't know what his answer would be. The other person I would interview on the complete opposite side of the coin is Elvis Presley, whose story I have admired, whose music I admired as a kid. Not the old fat Elvis, but the young Elvis. I think I have every record he ever made. And I would ask him if I could get him alone without any of those people around him or that mafia or whatever, you know, like, when did it turn? When did your life stop being fun? You were the American dream. You know, a country boy put on the Louisiana hayride, people start screaming for you, girls, you know, yelling your name, you're making the kind of music you always wanted to, and yet he died so miserable. When did that change? What happened? And I'd like to hear from his lips instead of everybody else's.
Well, with Mitch Albom, when we come back, we'll talk to him about Tuesdays with Maury. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
You're listening to Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Once again, here's your host, Jack Krasula.
We're with Mitch Albom, who wrote Tuesdays with Maury in 1997, and it sold over 10 million copies to date. 16 years, you didn't see or talk to Maury Schwartz. Then what happened?
I saw him on television. He was being interviewed by Ted Koppel on Nightline about what it was like to die. And it was only by that accidental flipping of the channels that I realized that this professor, who I had been very close with when I was in college, I mean, he wasn't just a guy that I took a class from. I took every class he offered. I ate at his house. We walked around campus together. He was more like an uncle to me there. I gave him a briefcase when I graduated and said goodbye. I mean, I thought that I would stay in touch with him forever. And I think a lot of people think that when they leave college about their professors and about their friends. And then life takes over and starts taking you all kinds of places. And next thing you know, you can't even remember their last names. And I had lost touch with him, and I saw him on television. He looked very sick and thin. And he was telling Ted Koppel about how he was coping with this terrible illness, Lou Gehrig's disease. And that's when a voice inside of me says, you have to at least call him. I didn't think I was going to see him as much as I did, but I made one phone call to him. And I remember I used to call Maury Coach when I was in college. It was like a sports affectation, I guess. You know, I coach, how you doing, coach, that kind of thing. And when I called him up after 16 years, and he answered the phone, and I said, hello, Professor Schwartz. I didn't even want to call him Maury because I didn't feel I had the right. I said, Professor Schwartz, this is Mitch Albom. I was a student of yours in the 70s. I don't know if you remember me. And the first thing he said to me was, how come you didn't call me coach? And I think right after he said that, something inside of me said, I think I'm going to have to go visit him. I'm not going to get away with a phone call. And that began the whole long process that we had.
For 16 Tuesdays in a row, you flew to Boston.
Mm-hmm.
How did those visits change your life?
Oh, gosh, Jack, it's immeasurable. I mean, it goes on right now, even as I'm talking to you. You know, at that time in my life, I really was, I was far more of a workaholic than I am now, although I still think I have too many of those tendencies. But I worked 7 days a week, 90 hours a week, easy. I lived in Bristol, Connecticut for 3 days a week just to film television shows up for ESPN. I wrote 5 columns a day. I did radio 5 days a week in the morning. I took freelance assignments. I did freelance local television assignments, magazine assignments. I didn't turn down anything because I thought, you know, I was one of those people that said, well, if I say no, they won't ask me again. And after I spent that time with Maury, and he kind of taught me about what does and doesn't matter in life and what's going to count when I reach my final day, as he did, I began to reshift my priorities. I cut down my work quite a bit. It still looks to the outside world that I do a lot, but I don't do anything really full time. And I've managed to whittle that down. I've also lost some of my fear of death because I watched it happen right in front of me. I've also learned how to speak to people who have troubles and who are ill, which I think is important. I learned a certain patience about doing that. Before the whole Tuesdays with Maury experience, the most common conversation I would have would be in an airport, and someone would stop me and say, who's going to win the Super Bowl? Or who's going to win the World Series? And, you know, you can answer that question while you keep walking. Oh, the Tigers. Oh, you know, the New England or whatever, and just walk. Now people will stop me and say, my mother died of cancer, and the last thing we did together was read your book out loud. Can I talk to you for a minute? Well, you can't just keep walking, can you? You have to stop. And you have to engage, and you have to listen to people sometimes break down and cry right in front of you. You know, they just start talking about someone who's gone, and then just start weeping. You don't even know their name. And I've had to learn how to be sensitive to that, what you can say and what you can't say, and to realize that there's this enormous well of sadness in the world that, you know, even we're sitting here, we're looking out on a window, and there are cars, and there are people out there, and I bet if I stopped every one of those cars on that street and said, pull over, I just want to ask you one question. Have you lost somebody in your life? Are you missing them right now? Is there a little hole in your heart for somebody? 99 out of 100 of them would say yes, and they'd tell you a story. But you never think of them that way. You just see them as faces in the crowd. Well, that's what changed for me. I began to understand that everybody has something like that in their life, and I began to gravitate more towards dealing with those kinds of issues in my writing, in my books, in my life, than I ever did before when I was just going to ball games.
On your last visit, both of you said to each other, I love you.
Hmm.
That is one of the hardest things for many men to say, fathers to sons, fathers to daughters, and vice versa. What would you say to a dad who has never told their kids, I love you?
Turn off the radio and go do it right now. You never know when that doctor tells you that you have, you know, 2 months left to live, that car that you see out of the corner of your eye suddenly is hitting yours and it's the end of your life. I mean, anything can take that precious moment that you have of living away. And I believe that you should tell your children you love them every single day of their lives. I believe a husband and a wife should tell them they love each other every single day of their lives. I don't just believe it, I practice it. I do it with my family, I do it with my parents, I do it on every phone call that I have with every relative of mine, be it a niece, a nephew, a brother, a sister, mother, father, or wife. I just don't think you can say it enough. I once heard a religious cleric tell me a story about a guy that he was doing a funeral service for, and after he buried his wife and after the service was over, this guy came up to this cleric and said, "I loved her so much." He was crying. "I loved her so much, and I almost told her a couple of times." That's tragic to me. It's tragic, and there's no reason for it. And much as I would like for people to continue listening to the two of us, if it means the difference between going and saying, telling your kids you love them, leave the radio and go do it right now. It's more important.
The book's signature line is, "Death ends a life, not a relationship."
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean by that?
Well, if you invest in people, as Maury did, you know, you make memories with people, you give your time to people, you share with people, then when you die, I don't think you're 100% gone. I think you live on inside the heads and hearts of everybody that you touched. And so you can have that relationship after death, but only if you had it here on Earth. A lot of people figure, oh, well, they'll remember me fondly after I'm gone. But, well, not if you're working all day and they never see you. You know, not if you never call them to talk to them. Then when you're gone, you're really gone. But if you spend so much time with somebody that you're part of their fabric, then after you're gone, they'll tell your stories. They'll pull out your photographs. They'll have conversations with you. You know how people who've lost their mother, they'll kind of get dreamy look in their face and they'll say, "I wonder what mom would do. You know, I wonder what mom would tell me." And they're kind of hearing their mother talk to them or hearing their father or their grandmother talk to them in those moments. So that relationship is going on even after they're gone, but only because they put themselves inside them at the time. I liken it, Jack, to a penny in a piggy bank. When you put a penny in a piggy bank, you can't see it anymore, right? For all intents and purposes, it's gone unless you shake it. And if you shake it, you hear it. It's inside. And it's the same thing with memories. If you shake people up and they hear, you know, memories get stirred, they live on because they're inside you.
Oprah Winfrey produced a major television movie based on Tuesdays with Maury.
Mm-hmm.
The movie was the most watched of any movie that year on the network. It also earned 4 Emmy Awards, including Best Actor by Jack Lemmon and Best Supporting Actor by Hank Azaria.
Mm-hmm.
What was that like, Mitch?
Well, more for them than for me, I think. I was flattered by the movie. I thought she did a great job. I was flattered that Jack Lemmon wanted to play Maury, and I got to know him a bit before he died, and he told me that that was his favorite role. In fact, he told us on WJR in a radio interview that was, of all the roles that he'd done, that was his favorite, which is incredible. This is a guy who's won Oscars and done some of the best work ever in cinema. The reason that he said that, I found out later, was because he was dying as he was making that film. He had had, I believe it was a form of cancer, and unbeknownst to anybody there, he had been diagnosed with it, and he realized his time was short. It turned out to be the last movie he really was in, and I think that's why he took it on so special and did such a great job. And Hank Azaria had the unfortunate luck of playing me, which I tease him about incessantly. He and I are still friends. I saw him in New York a couple of weeks ago. I said, "You know, when you reach that old age home for actors and you're going to be sitting next to some guy who said, 'I played Othello,' and you're going to have to turn to him and say, 'Yeah, I played Mitch Albom,' and aren't you going to feel stupid?" But he's a great guy and a great talent. So I made a lot of nice friendships out of that movie.
We're talking to Mitch Albom. When we come back, we'll ask him about the 5 people you meet in heaven. I'm Jack Krasula. This is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
You're listening to Anything Is Possible with Jack Krasula, sponsored by Trust in Us on News Talk 760 WJR.
Welcome back. We're with Mitch Albom. Mitch, the 5 people you meet in heaven is a story about a character named Eddie, who was an 83-year-old amusement park maintenance man as he meets five people in heaven whose lives he somehow touched, for better or worse. Who was your inspiration for Eddie?
I actually had an uncle named Eddie who very much was the inspiration for that character. He looked like him. He talked like him. He was 83 when he died. He was a World War II veteran who I adored. He was like the first tough guy I ever met, and, you know, as a kid. He was one of these muscle-bound, short, stocky guys, and we used to jump on his arms, and he would lift us up by his biceps, that kind of thing. He was like Popeye. And after the war, he never left the apartment that he lived in until the day that he died. And he used to refer to himself as a nobody. He said, "I'm nobody. I'm nothing. I never been nowhere. Never done anything." And I always felt that that was so sad, because I didn't think of him as a nobody. I mean, I thought that he was a special guy, and he was a good guy just for being honest and for loving us and for being a family member. But I never really could convince him of that. And he died, I think, kind of sadly. He never really got to travel or see anything. And so I wrote this story about a guy who was kind of like him, who also thinks that his life doesn't matter on Earth, that he's a nobody. He fixes rides at an amusement park. I mean, talking about the invisible man. Nobody ever sees the guy who fixes the rides at the amusement park. And he dies trying to save a little girl from an accident there, and he winds up in heaven, and he finds out that this first stage of heaven is where you meet five people who were in your life at some point or another. Some you might have known very well, but some might have been strangers to you, and each one sort of has one thing to share with you about something that you might not have realized about your interactions with them on Earth, some way you affected them and they affected you. And by the end of these five people, he comes to realize that he didn't lead a nothing life at all. He affected a lot of people, even though he didn't realize it. And I think that that's pretty much true of everybody.
Have you ever thought, Mitch Albom, who the five people you're going to meet in heaven are?
You're making a big presumption there, Jack. Let's not jump the gun. But if I should be lucky enough, and that's where I would end up, first of all, it's a novel and it's just an idea. But if you want me to answer in terms of the idea of it, well, I certainly would like to see Maury again. I would like to see my Uncle Eddie, and I'd like to see my Uncle Mike. He was my mother's brother who kind of half-raised me and died very young. And he named me. He taught me how to play piano. He taught me sports, and I miss him terribly, and he died way too young, and I sure would like to see him again. But I think of the other two, I would like to think that maybe there are some people, also as the book suggests, that maybe I affected some people while I was here that I don't know about, you know, that maybe just a little interaction that we had changed their path and they went on to do something good or important. And maybe I'd be lucky enough to meet somebody like that and realize that some of those days that I didn't think I was getting anything done or doing anything or influencing anybody, maybe I did. That would be a nice thing to find out. But we'll have to do that on another show. And boy, what a show that'll be. Me up there and you here. Or you'll probably be there and I might likely be someplace else.
No, give me a good word. You've authored 8 books, 3 plays. You're a musician. You've won Top Sports Writer 13 in the last 15 years. You write articles every day, 2 on Sunday, ESPN Sports Writers, on and on and on. Why do you continue to do all of this?
Yeah, you sound like a lot of people around me, actually. I don't know. I don't do as much of it as I used to. I only work for the newspaper maybe half a year. I'm lucky enough at this radio station that they let me have a lot of time off, more than I think the standard deal is, because I couldn't do it otherwise. I don't have a book every year. I mean, I have a new book coming out in September, which is called For One More Day, and it's the first book since The Five People You Meet in Heaven. That was 3 years ago, and Five People You Meet in Heaven was 6 years from Tuesdays with Maury, so people may think I put out a lot of books, but I take a long time in between. The answer to why I do it, number one, I love it. I mean, I don't do anything that I don't like, and I guess I've always been a little afraid of just giving something up altogether, because, you know, when I started out in the working world, I didn't have a penny to my name, and I was always afraid of being broke and not being wanted or needed anywhere. And so I'm a little slow to give things up, even though eventually I will. But basically, I do one thing, Jack. I only do one thing. I tell stories. I tell them in books. I tell them in a column. I go on television and I tell my version of something. I go on the radio and I kind of tell stories. It's not like dentistry and rodeo riding. You know, it's not like I have that much skill. It's just one thing. I'm a communicator. I can't cook. I can't dress well. I I drive an old car. I mean, I don't have any abilities in a lot of other areas. I'm really hopeless in a lot of other areas. I just, I know how to do this one thing. And I like doing it so much that, you know, I guess I just fill up all the opportunities I can.
Could you give us a little sneak preview of what For One More Day is about?
Yeah, it's about a guy who had to choose when he was young between his mother and his father because of a divorce, and he sort of chose his father and made the wrong decision and never really appreciated his mother. And his life kind of spirals downhill when he's an older person. He loses his family, and he becomes an alcoholic. And one night he goes to take his own life, and he goes back to his own small town where he grew up to do it, and he fails at trying to do it, and he wanders back into his old house and finds his mother still living there, although she's been dead for 10 years. And he spends this one day with her and finds out all these things about his childhood and who he was and who she was that he didn't know. He gets this one last ordinary day to spend with his mother again, and his life is turned around as a result of it.
You meet and talk to fantastic people every day who are living their dreams. What do these special people have in common?
A lack of fear. If I had to, you know, unify the people who have been really accomplished in all kinds of walks of life, whether they be, you know, business people, musicians, politicians, artists, whatever, it always seems that there was some point in their life where they could have chickened out, or they could have taken a safe road, or they could have just stayed in the pack, and they didn't. They gambled, they took out a second mortgage, they took that trip overseas that everyone told them they were crazy to take, and something happened for them as a result of that. And I think people can do great things. Everybody can do great things. I think the thing that holds people back from doing great things more often than any other element is fear. They don't want to stand out. They don't want to take a chance. They don't want to risk losing the safe thing that they have. So they just stay with it even though they're not crazy about it. And if I could give a gift to, you know, to my children or young people, whatever, it would be to eliminate fear from their lives and let them see that the world's an amazing place and you can take a chance and you'll probably have a soft landing no matter what. I mean, as long as you can breathe and walk around and find food to put in your mouth, you're okay. And especially when you're young, you can try so many different things. And I see so many young people who feel like they have to make up their mind about who they want to be when they're 16 years old, you know, and they got to declare a major before they even get to college, and they have to have a job path already laid out. And I feel sorry for them. I'm an accident. I'm a walking proof that you can have plans for one thing and you can end up in something else. We're talking on the radio. I work on the radio. I had no interest in radio. I didn't even think about radio. I wanted to be a rock star, you know, when I was a kid. I wanted to be a musician. Well, I didn't do that. But I ended up writing books. I didn't write anything till I was 23 years old. I couldn't even write a story, and you know, I just had no interest in it. And yet, it turns out to be my passion because I was willing to try this or go here or give it a shot. What's the big deal if I fail? And I think people need to do that more.
We have 1 minute left. What advice would you give to our young listeners tonight?
Well, this is going to be a very complicated world for our young listeners because it's very. Computer-oriented, very distant, and I've already said what I would about taking chances and not being afraid, but I would encourage them to get more human. This world is getting very distanced, you know, people talking to each other over computers, internets, cell phones. Spend more time with human beings. You know, learn the magic of humanity. Learn the magic of holding an old person's hand. Learn the magic of a conversation with a loved one. Turn off the noise. Don't have televisions playing when you're having conversations. Just converse with somebody. Be in the moment when you're actually spending it with somebody, and you'll be amazed at how enriched your life is.
Mitch, thanks much for all you do. There are hundreds of thousands of us out there who look forward to meet you in heaven and tell you you've made a difference in their lives.
Thank you, Jack.
Thanks. Please join us next Sunday. Until then, I'm Jack Krasula. Thanks for listening, and make it a great week, because with God, anything truly is possible. Spoken.